Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. We've got a number of topics to discuss tonight, from handball rules to the nature of England's relationship with the media, and we'll throw in a bit of non-league and FA Cup talk too. As ever, I've got some great guests to help me discuss it all. Firstly, with analysis as clinical and incisive as a Jordan Pickford lunge and an opposing player wearing red, it's Paul McBarl. And welcome, Paul.
Hi, Aidan. Yeah, I love that introduction, by the way. That works so well. As long as we can avoid talking about today's match, I'm quite happy to stay on the programme.
Well, we'll see about that. Of course, Paul is referring to Newcastle 2, Everton 1. You know, it wasn't quite what I was expecting, but we were both in negative mindsets about this one, and my negativity proved less justified than yours. Let's just leave it at that. And in Birmingham, where it's all about the magical feat of Ivan Sanchez at the moment, I gather. Matthew Gibbs, how are you?
I'm not doing too bad, thanks. Things are going quite well. The season's looking up.
I know. I see you. A couple of months ago when you were on, it was a little more doom and gloom. It's going quite well.
You can hear the surprise in my voice.
Good stuff. And we've got a last-minute substitute on the pod tonight, the ever-dependable Stephen Scragg. How are you tonight, Stephen?
Oh, very well. Thanks, Aidan. You've saved me from an evening of refereeing children who don't want to go to bed the night before going back to school. So this is all good for me.
All part of the service. Good stuff. Well, before we get into today's subjects, a word first on the great Nobby Stiles, who died this week, age 78. A great, combative and skillful midfielder, of course. He's remembered very well for his victory jig after the 66 World Cup final and his key role in that team, and indeed the Manchester United European Cup winning team of a couple of years later. I mean, Paul, a quick word from you on Stiles, as someone who will probably seen a lot more of his career than the rest of us, perhaps. A real great of the game, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And a shining example of a player who wasn't the most skillful player, wasn't the most talented player, yet, you know, went on to be one of the few people who can claim to have won both the European Cup and a World Cup winner's medal as well. So full credit to him for what he managed to achieve during the course of his career. And he's the type of player who was obviously managers, in particular Matt Busby and Alf Ramsey, could rely on intently to do the job they required them to do during the game. And can I just tell one little story about Nobby Stiles?
Certainly.
Well, when Leeds and Man United always had a bit of an ongoing thing between them. And before one game, probably in the mid-60s, as the teams were coming down the tunnel, Bobby Collins absolutely whacked George Best on the back of the calves and whispered into his ear, "That's just for starters, Georgie, if you try any of your tricks today." Two teams walked onto the pitch. 1 minute after kickoff, the ball's by the touchline. Collins about to control the ball. Stiles came charging in, knocked him off the ball, crashed him into the perimeter fence, stood over him, said, "If you come effing near our Georgie again, I'll effing do that to you, only effing twice as hard next time."
That's great. I mean, that sums the guy up. He was feisty. There's no mistake about that, but skillful as well with it. I mean, his performances, Stephen, in the World Cup win, notably the stifling job he did in Eusebio in the semi-final, was possibly one of his most defining performances.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about Alf Ramsey's World Cup winning side is, you know, the shape and the pattern of them and the jobs that they did tend to get lost somewhat behind, kind of like the fact that it's the only time England have won a World Cup. And in a way, it's almost become, I don't know, a bit of a parody of itself almost, if that's the right terminology. It's a bit like Marco Tardelli and his goal and his celebration in the 82 final. It becomes such a synonymous image that it somehow loses its meaning. But I think when you can look behind kind of the cartoon character almost, the cartoon image of something like this, is that side had a set of players in it that were there to do a specific job, and it was a wonderful job that they did. You know, for Stiles, you can also tick the box there for Jack Charlton, Lucky enough to watch an advanced screening of the Jack Charlton documentary that's out soon, and my respect of a player and a manager there, only increased more than anything else. And Nobby Styles was exactly the same type of character that did all the essentials that was needed of that side. Without a Styles, without a Jack Charlton, then, Bobby Charlton, isn't performing in the way that he is. Bobby Moore can't stride around imperiously like the way that he does. That England side that won that World Cup was underpinned by players like Nobby Styles.
Yeah, and you mentioned Bobby Charlton there. And he was a huge admirer of Styles, obviously, for club and country, crediting much of what the both teams achieved to his dogged midfield colleague. I mean, I guess we've got news of Bobby Charlton this week too, that he's suffering dementia, but it's all about Styles at the moment. I guess, Matthew, there's increasingly few of the boys of 66 with us, so it's the kind of topic we'll be picking up again, I imagine, in months to come.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's really sad. I can't say I know too much specifically about Nobby Styles, of some of my age, but he's one of those names. Like, everyone knows the name. Everyone knows the name Nobby Styles, which says a lot about the man and about the player. And yeah, it's a sad loss.
Well, from the greatness of Nobby Styles to something not so great in the game today. Now, bear with me a little bit on this explanation, but a new handball rule was rolled out by football's lawmakers, IFAB, ahead of last season initially. Which led to any accidental handball by the attacking team in the build-up to a goal being given as a handball, while handballs by the defending team were routinely given as penalties regardless of intent. Now, many of the major leagues across Europe implemented this fully. It was only in England where this stricter interpretation was not fully implemented last season. FIFA then stepped in this summer, insisting on uniformity of the laws of the game across the world. So the Premier League had to get in line with the rest. IFAB, off the back of that, then sought to clarify things this season, clarify or adjust or complicate, depending on your perspective, as a result of FIFA's demand. So accidental handballs would only be an offence if it occurred immediately before a goal. They also then amended where on the body was deemed a handball, whereas last season it was the entire arm from the shoulder to the fingertips. Now it's from level with the armpit, so effectively from the point where a short shirt sleeve would end. So these new rules effectively remove the need for a handball offence to be deliberate. Well, now the judgment is about whether a player has made their arm unnaturally bigger, regardless of intent. Paul, coming to you first on all of this. I mean, I guess they were seeking to provide clarity and remove some subjectivity from the decision-making, but in penalising even accidental handballs, does it make you think they just simply hadn't thought through the consequences of what they were trying to do?
I'm not sure, Aidan, because it's a really complicated rule. I think handball, is the arm in an unnatural position. I mean, that's a really sort of a flimsy guideline in terms of trying to interpret what a player's actions are. And I think I can understand that the need for consistency, because for me, if we were a member of FIFA, it made no sense that our referees interpreted that law in a different manner to their counterparts in the rest of the FIFA society. So the consistency, yes. I think to a large extent, the whole thing is being magnified by VAR. I think it's more the VAR decisions about what is handball and what isn't handball that have caused the controversy rather than the actual decisions on the pitch. And I think, without the VAR intervention in this sphere, I don't think we'll be talking about it that much, but it's a really, really complicated rule. It's really difficult, I think, for referees to make an on-the-spot decision there. I'm sure it's difficult for people in the VAR studio to look and come to a consistent decision. But, in some ways, to me, it's more important to have consistency of decision rather than being the right decision or not, because at least then it's the same for both sides in every match that they play. And you're never going to keep... No one was happy with the interpretation last season. No surprise, nobody's happy with the interpretation this season, although you might have been for the Kieran Dyer one a few weeks ago. And so from that point of view, I think they tried to make it as clear as possible. They maybe end up making it more unclear than could be imaginable, but it's a really difficult rule. It's a really difficult interpretation. And I think it begs a more wider ranging discussion on whether when the ball hits you and in that position in the penalty area, should it always be a penalty? Do we need to actually look at what constitutes a penalty these days? Because so many more teams getting penalties, it's almost making a mockery of the whole system. And your team's playing on the handball situation deliberately to gain an advantage. And maybe we need to look at the consequence of the decision that's given when the ball hits the defender's hands.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that. Obviously, this has had a big impact on the number of penalties awarded in the Premier League so far this season. For a bit of perspective, it's consistent with what was seen last season across Europe, where this rule was already being followed. So, you mentioned there, yes, the Spurs against Newcastle one, hitting Eric Dier's arm from behind, where he had no idea where the ball was, frankly. But because his arm was deemed to be making his body unnaturally bigger, it was a penalty. I guess, building on what Paul's saying there, Matthew, is the increase in the number of penalties given a price worth paying for that consistency? Or is it a bit of a ridiculous outcome that it's just highlighting either the inadequacy of the rule, or is it, as Paul again mentioned, it's being exacerbated by the use of VAR, which is highlighting things that may have slipped a net previously?
I totally agree about the highlighting the VAR. The handball law wasn't really a problem until VAR came in, when you can double check everything and you can get really into the intricacies and highlight things down to a minute detail. But I totally agree with what Paul said. I think we've forgotten like what the point of all these punishments and all these like handballs are, and what the point of a penalty is. Like a penalty is the most serious punishment in football for a foul play or for deliberate handball or an attempt to gain an advantage or negatively affect an opponent's play. It's blocking or stopping a goal scoring opportunity. That's the point of a penalty. The point of a penalty is not when a ball bounces off an elbow, or when, I think the worst example I can think of is when Juventus played Atalanta last season, and it was a 2-2. And Juventus got two really dodgy penalties. One of them was the ball was going out of the box. The direction was out of the box and it hit an Atalanta player's arms. That's not a penalty. He's not denying a goal-scoring opportunity. The punishment doesn't fit the crime at all. And yeah, I totally agree with that, like with VAR, like highlighting all the, you know, all the tiny details, whether it bounces off an elbow, whether that counts as handball or not. It's a bit of a farce. It doesn't really make any sense.
I guess when we're talking there, though, about what constitutes a penalty and what kind of handball would be a penalty, that's just increasing the subjectivity about it, I suppose, isn't it? And that's, I assume, what they're trying to get away from and try to bring consistency by making it clearer. But obviously, the consequence of that is there are so many more penalties. I mean, there's the subjectivity still of the question of what constitutes an unnatural position or extending the body. To me, it seems almost the worst compromise in some way. Should they either have made absolutely any contact with the arm a handball, or left it as it was previously, merely judging on intent, or perhaps some of these other options that the guys are mentioning, Stephen?
The more that they try to fix it, the more of a mess they make. To change it from that sense of intent, it comes down to the rule makers in that respect, is that you've got to wonder whether they're actually consulting with players, you know, who play the game. You know, are these just simply kind of like bureaucratic watchers of the game? You know, football is an ever altering game. As soon as the ball kicks off, you know, the game alters, it changes, it morphs. No, it's not, you know, no two balls across a penalty area are the same. You know, that concept of how close is the ball when it is kicked to a player, you know, how much thinking time does a player have before the ball comes to him? You know, there's also, it's like the concept of kind of like, you know, handball and counting from kind of like the shirt sleeve down. But, you know, a player can lean into a ball and control it with the shoulder or the upper arm. There's all sorts of vagaries and variations of how a player will approach a ball with the use of an arm. But within that, it always comes down to intent. And that's the best way that you can possibly judge it. You know, and you can't come up with a black and white approach to the rule, because there are so many different ways. You know, it's not just down to the body of a player and the position of the player. It's what's going through that player's mind at that point in time when contact is made. You know, is that an action that's happening in the 89th minute with the scoreline at 2-2? Is that an action that's happening with 20 minutes to go in a game that's 6-0? You know, there are all sorts of variables behind a handball. Some of the things that used to do my head in was the fact that you'd see a handball not given in a penalty area, and then you'd say, well, if that was happening on the halfway line, then that would be a free kick. So there is that lack of, you know, it's that difference between the rule being applied within the 18-yard area to the rule being applied elsewhere on the pitch. And for me, it needs to be a degree of simplicity and an application of common sense. And for me, that just comes down to the fact that it needs to be the referee reading the game and applying his interpretation of intent.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's as we obviously mentioned, it's VAR that's highlighting these issues a little more than would have been the case before. They're trying to juggle with a rule that has worked, you know, more or less well for a long time, but VAR is highlighting the issues worked, with it, isn't it?
But they go hand in hand. So, you know, yeah. VAR, I'm an advocate of VAR to an extent. You know, I believe it can be a good thing if it is used correctly. Now, VAR for me, you know, you could look at an incident like yesterday, you know, with the Liverpool West Ham game, when a goal was disallowed after Mane made contact with the goalkeeper. Within that, again, a million variables over why that happened. But what you have in an incident like that, and this isn't handball, but this is just an incident that's happened, and then people have been watching it on a screen, a VAR screen, and then the referees had to wait for the interpretation to come through and say, you need to go over and have a look at the screen. Now, this incident took about two and a half, three minutes to clear up. Now, for me, any kind of incident, whether it's a handball or it's a challenge or whatever it is, there has to be a degree of determination to it. There has to be a degree of certainty to it. Now, I'm a believer that if you implement VAR like that and there's a grey area of an incident, there should be maybe like a 60-second rule on it. You know, because if you've got to sit there and watch six different angles two or three times, and a tilt of the head and still not be sure and then ask the referee to adjudicate, then there's enough doubt there that the original decision should stand, no matter what that's been, for the flow of the game as well. And there was an incident today in the Newcastle Everton game, wasn't it, with the penalty, and the player was stood there waiting to take the penalty while they were judging it on VAR. Now, we've seen in the past in the way that a penalty is awarded, and if the longer it takes for the penalty to be taken, the more likely the kicker is going to be sighted out of scoring. So within that, that had such a massive knock-on effect. You know, the ball went in the back of the net on this occasion, but on another occasion, that might be a missed penalty. And it's come down to the fact that, you know, officials both on the pitch and in a VAR booth are discussing whether this should be a penalty or not. So, you know, there needs to be a speeding up of the VAR process, and that will help decisions on the pitch.
Yeah, I'd agree both with what Matthew and what Stephen said there, Aidan. Matthew, your point about what constitutes a penalty these days, I think is spot on. I think we do need to look at whether this handball thing is a penalty anymore, because I, like you, think a penalty is a denying of a goal-scoring opportunity in the penalty area, and I don't think the ball hitting you on the arm shoulder accidentally can be justified as a penalty anymore. And I totally agree with what Steve says as well. I think there should be a time limit on the VAR decision. If they haven't made the decision within 60, 90 seconds, then at that stage, the decision stands, or the referee goes over and checks on the screen. Because if you're debating that decision that much, then there obviously hasn't been a clear and obvious error. So, you know, to me, a time limit makes absolute sense. And just going back to the VAR issue as well, I mean, One of the things that's concerned me all season about VAR is that the elite group of referees, they all know each other, they're all friendly, they're all pals, they all train together. So it's very hard for them to go against each other's decisions because they're meeting each other socially, professionally, on a regular basis. Is there any merit in the VAR referees not being the Premier League lot? Any merit in having the VAR referees being from Scotland? So they're not friends off the pitch, so they don't know each other. So they're not afraid to make a call and say, Assey, you've made a balls up there. That's a completely wrong decision. You need to go back and check that again. Because I just think the whole thing is way, way, way too cosy. And linked to that, does anyone assess the VAR judges? Referees are assessed, aren't they, by match assessors during the game. Does anybody assess the performance of VAR referees? Or is it just accepted that their decision is what counts? Does anyone actually monitor how many times we've got it wrong or right?
You would certainly hope they do.
But do they, Aidan? I mean, I know referees are monitored. I know that they're always concerned about the feedback. But if the VAR referees are in a situation where they know no one's judging their performance, there's going to be no feedback, they're not going to lose their jobs, then to me, by any professional standards, that doesn't seem right.
It's interesting you mentioned about VAR teams coming from somewhere else in a Premier League context. I was watching some of the South American qualifiers last month. A similar situation happened there in the Peru-Brazil game, I think it was. And all the referee and the VAR assistants were all from Chile, who have a dubious past with Peru in politically. But whether that changed anything in this game, I don't know. But it was definitely mentioned in the commentary around penalty incidents that Brazil got that... the Chilean crew were certainly favouring the Brazilians rather than the Peruvians. I mean, the situation there where, for example, if the VAR ref had been from Uruguay, for instance, maybe they'd have been slightly more impartial compared to their pal, the referee, I guess. Similar situation.
I just think it's unhealthy, the fact that the VAR team is the same as the refereeing team, because I think there's a conflict of interest there. And I think if you had the other possibility could be to employ ex-referees in the VAR booth. So you bring back Mark Clattenburg, you bring back Jeff Winter, though for all their faults, but at least they won't be afraid of saying to the match officials, no, that's wrong.
And they don't have to run around.
Even throw into that, the VAR officials maybe should be ex-players.
Yeah, well, I said, there should be at least one there, Steve. I agree with that totally, yeah.
Yeah, it's good, because they know exactly how it works on a football pitch. You can have, when it comes to the handball rule, for instance, there can be an accidental handball that is worthy of being a penalty. It might be a case of, the positioning of the arm. We've all seen before, if a player jumps and his arms are outstretched, then, there can be, certain circumstances where an accidental handball has altered the path of the ball to such an extent that it needs to be a penalty. But it's one of those calls that is just solely based on experience of the game and, that knowledge of, yes or no. I've said before, it's a rule that can't be black and white. Can't be black and white, but there is a yes and a no side to it. There is a blatant, aspect to the handball rule. Was it, accidental? Yes or no. Was it on purpose? Yes or no. But, on some occasions, an accidental handball can, result in a penalty, and rightly so. But within that, I think only people who play the game and get the body movements and the physical aspect of a football match taking place, can truly know the difference between the two.
Recent weeks have seen the impact that this season's adjusted handball law is having on offside as well. VAR, again, serving to highlight this in the extreme, with fine lines being drawn on the pitch. And the recent Merseyside derby gave us a few clear examples of these finite details that now seem to be a regular occurrence when judging offside. Again, this is an unintended consequence of the handball, in that the attacker has effectively been extended for offside for this season. So, whereas it was cut off his arm at the armpit last year to say where was the furthest position forwards, now, because you can play the ball and indeed score a goal with the very top of your arm or shoulder under current rules, this has moved. Last season, they would calculate from that armpit. Now it's the outer part of the upper arm, if that's furthest forward. This makes an attacking player offside merely by having their arm extended out, as was the case with both Van Dijk and Mane in the Merseyside derby. They're just two of numerous recent examples. So in Paul, again, this seems to be another unintended consequence of the clarification. VAR had already removed or tried to remove a potential element of the benefit of doubt going to the attacking team. Now it's all about these lines on the screen, flagging more and more players as offside when to the naked eye appear not to be. Has seeking clarity again just simply added to everyone's frustration here?
Yeah, I think so. I believe part of the difficulty is that it's come down to minute metric decisions now about, you know, whether someone's 0.5222 of a centimetre offside with their elbow when the ball's played into the penalty area. And I think by trying to be too exact, they've actually taken some of the joy out of the game in terms of when you're watching it as a fan, because you can't celebrate a goal anymore when you go to a match, because the first thing you're doing is checking the screen is the VAR check. Then you celebrate and think it's going to be allowed, and then, you know, a minute, 2 minutes later, 5 minutes later, it gets disallowed, and all that joy is just taken away from you. So, you know, I looked around the games last season, and people were more and more reluctant to actually celebrate a goal until they knew it was going to be confirmed, which to me is anti-football. But I think this is one area where you're thinking, use some common sense. And I think, you know, if you use the yardstick, does the attacker gain an advantage by his fingernail being a centimetre offside? But the answer is clearly not. And I think this is one area where, rather than the VAR team making the decision on purely mathematical grounds, I'd go along with what Steve was saying before, have an ex-pro in there, have an ex-pro looking at it as well and saying, actually, come on, that's a good goal, it's a well-worth move. You're not seriously going to disallow that goal because of that minute fraction of offside. I think that this more than the handball rule concerns me, because the handball rule does not always involve goals being scored or goals being conceded. The offside rule often does. And I just think, as an entertainment sport, we're kind of backing ourselves into a bit of a corner here if decisions are going to be made by officials 200 miles away from the stadium, looking at a TV screen and making the decision based on these so-called wavy lines as to whether it's offside or not.
Yeah, Matthew, in the Dutch league, they currently have a 10-centimetre margin of error allowed in these decisions, along with an umpire's call-style deference to the referee's original decision if that margin isn't clear. In terms of the issue we're talking about, what do you think of that approach?
I don't hate the umpire call, actually. It works quite, and admittedly, very different sports, but it works quite well in cricket, isn't it, when you can sort of challenge decisions. And the 10-centimetre rule makes sense to me, because I'm a bit like Paul. I don't really understand how like an arm being offside is an advantage when you legally are not allowed to use the arm to do anything anyway. It's not an advantage if you're going to score with his hand. No, it's not allowed. I think a lot of the problems that comes with this is, I think, I don't want to sound like, you know, one of those guys you hear at the back of the terraces, but the standard of refereeing at the minute is really poor. There aren't very many good referees. So they're trying to cover the referees' backs by changing the laws. And then you look at who is in charge of IFAB and in charge of the laws. It's David Ellery, who I heard this on another pod, and I don't know how true it is, but apparently is it 2 or 3 years he's been in charge of IFAB, he has made something like 180 changes to the laws. And the only one he hasn't tampered with is the one that states the ball should be round, which I think says a lot about David Ellery and a lot about the state of referees at the minute. But if you ask any Blues fan, to be honest, we'll tell you from the Worthington Cup final in 2001 that David Ellery is not great at his job, when he should have awarded us a penalty but never did.
Well, our complaints on this issue could be added to the likes of Roy Hodgson, who described it as a nonsense recently, as did Steve Bruce, despite benefiting from a dubious handball against Spurs, as we mentioned earlier. To address these issues, I guess, given VAR seems to be here to stay for the time being anyway, FIFA have set up what they call a technical innovations department, which sounds rather terrifying, frankly, but they've apparently been working on a semi-automated offside for some time, with a planned rollout for the 2022 World Cup, so that'll be something to look forward to. This semi-automated system, it says here in this rather fancy-looking document, will provide more accurately calculated the exact moment of the pass rather than using frames and map each player more accurately. Stephen, are they seeking a solution to a problem that simply doesn't exist if they just judge things based on intent, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, it's coming up with extra problems to accentuate problems that they've already caused, basically. You know, football's at its best when it's simplified. You know, you can say that about patterns of play, you know, styles of play. Absolutely everything to do with football is always better when it's stripped back to its most simplistic form. And offside rules, handballs, you know, just everything to do with the football match, it needs to come back to some kind of, you know, stripped back simplicity. You know, the more that you overcomplicate an issue, the more various, you know, tangents that it is likely to drift by, because you will open one can of worms and then immediately the next person says, well, there's another three over there, let's open them up as well.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the approach they're taking with this one, doesn't it? Get further down that corridor of uncertainty and just keep on searching for more cans of worms, as you say. Anyway, we'll switch subjects for now. Handball, offsides and VAR can wait for another day now. We'll look instead at the relationship between the England national team and the media. Now, this had improved considerably in recent years during Gareth Southgate's reign. The 2018 World Cup saw success not just on the pitch, but also in the way the team were perceived and portrayed. I mean, Matthew, it's potentially souring again now, probably in large extent, thanks to a number of high-profile issues recently. There's the Harry Maguire case in Greece, plus several COVID-related indiscretions of Phil Foden and Mason Greenwood first in Iceland, and then Abraham Chilwell and Sancho more recently. Have the players brought this greater scrutiny or more soured relationship on themselves?
Yes, I think they have to a degree, because judging like using Twitter as a barometer isn't the most sensible thing to do, but just seeing the backlash that there has been over the last couple of international windows to Gareth Southgate and seeing how people want him sacked is kind of insane, especially when, as you mentioned, there's so many different reasons why things are not entirely rosy at the minute. We're living through a pandemic where there was no international football for 8 months. And then to have the players come back and expect them to play, you know, they don't play together every week, to have them play together in free-flowing football, it's not possible. The team had tons of injuries and the obscene amount of really dumb COVID breaches by players, which is nothing to do with Gareth Southgate. It's not his fault. It's an impossible situation for him. Admittedly, yeah, I think Southgate is a limited manager, which I think therefore makes him a good international manager, because he doesn't need the sort of tactical nuances of club football. And his tactics were sort of unnecessarily defensive, but the swing from, you know, the guy we love in the waistcoat to this joker who's not fit for the job, the swing was huge. And I think it speaks more to, it felt a lot more like the coverage that the England team would receive like 5-10 years ago, as opposed to what they have received since the 2018 World Cup. And I think the relationship between the media and the English national team is, it's quite toxic, and it's quite, it's something very like wrong with it. I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, we won a World Cup in 1966, and that creates this crazy levels of expectation and a sense of arrogance. Because I think, I mean, speaking as an Englishman who has lived abroad, a lot of other countries around the world and even others in the Union, like Scotland and Wales, would look at England and say we're quite arrogant. And that creates this kind of weird mix of expectations where anything less than perfection is unacceptable. And the further and further away the World Cup in 1966 gets, the more godlike it becomes, making it even harder to compare to it. So I do think the players brought it on themselves recently, but it speaks a lot larger to the sort of the longer relationship between the media and English men.
Just specifically on those players, though, Matthew, should there have been a greater level of punishment rather than just being left out for one game and swiftly brought back into the fold?
For Greenwood and for Foden, definitely, yeah, because what they did wasn't just dumb, it was dangerous. Like, it's a pandemic, it's a killer pandemic, and people are dying around the world, like thousands and thousands of people. What they did wasn't just like a silly indiscretion, it was life-endangering. it puts people in danger. Like, it's one of those situations where you have no idea if you're infecting people, if they're infecting you, and for what they did was really dangerous and really dumb, and they should definitely receive a lot longer, more of a punishment, to be honest. The other one, I'm not so sure, because I think Sammy Abraham can have an excuse, because I don't think he knew he was going to a party. So, I mean, it's a bit unfair, isn't it? Like, you just sort of turn up and it's like, it's a party with 100 people. You shouldn't be doing this, but thanks. Whereas the other guys, I think it was Sancho and Mason Mount, if I'm right, I can't remember now.
Chilwell, I think.
They knew a bit more what was going on, didn't they? So, yeah, I think that one's a bit of a grey area. The Harry Maguire one, though, I think almost doesn't really have an effect on England. Like, that's his own sort of separate thing that didn't happen, like, while in England duty. Like, I think Southgate should have left him out just purely for, like his, he had other stuff going on and sort of, you know, mental health reasons. But I don't think that one has too much of a play on the English and sort of England, if you guys agree, I'm sure.
You know, and there's also a bit of a troubled media relationship with some key black players. I guess Raheem Sterling is principal among them, Stephen. And many scrutinies of aspects of his personal life seem to be placed under greater scrutiny than some other players, possibly more indicative of wider societal issues in this case. But how do examples like this, and as well as the attention that we're talking about with Matthew there about the recent COVID breaches, how do they affect the expectations of the team? Is the media perhaps less patient or tolerant of poor performances as a result of not just those indiscretions, but the sort of hounding of certain players that Sterling has suffered?
There's very much an institutionalised view of black players. You know, they are reported on, you know, they are the careers, the lives are chronicled in a way that white players simply aren't. You know, you can look at whether that's, you know, what happens on the pitch, or, you know, certain instances that might happen between two different players. You know, it could be the same occurrence, two different players and a completely different set of judging and morals towards those instances, whether it's a white player or a black player. You'd hope it is better than it was. You'd hope that it can get better than it it has to get better than it is. But yeah, you know, I think you look at someone like Raheem Sterling, you know, if Raheem Sterling steps out of line, you know, there is a lot more said about it than if it's Harry Kane. And that's just, you know, it should be a shocking thing. And sadly, it isn't, but for all the wrong reasons.
I mean, there's been quite a fractious past between England and the media. It's not just a recent phenomenon at all, is it, Paul? I mean, on the coaching side, from Bobby Robson to Graham Taylor, Glenn Hoddle, Ericsson, and many, many more, was it ever thus, really?
Well, yeah, I think that's always been the case. And we talked about Nobby Styles before. Even when Alf Ramsey was managing in 66, the press were criticising him for some of the tackle Styles was doing during the group stage games and saying he wasn't fit to play for England. So the press has always been quite antagonistic towards the England manager. I think Matthew hits upon the point there. Since Southgate stopped wearing his waistcoat, the whole relationship with the press has just gone down. I think that's been the key. Absolutely. But I think as well, I mean, you look at Southgate, I think part of the problem was he raised expectations by getting us to the World Cup semi-final in 2018. He raised expectations by getting us to the Nations Cup final. And then if he'd won either of those two, then basically I think he was on a golden ticket for life, but he didn't. And when it came to the key matches, he didn't win. And I think that's kind of built the pressure on Southgate that he's got them so far, but is he the man to get us to the next stage? Now, I think his England record compares very favourably with other predecessors in the post. But I think recent performances, and they've been, you know, let's be honest, they've been totally underwhelming in terms of entertainment value. Leads then to people to go back into his past and say, well, hang on, he was never actually that good a manager at club level anyway. Then that starts to raise more questions about whether he's then the suitable man for the England job. So he's kind of in a really difficult situation here. I thought he handled the Harry Maguire situation quite poorly. I don't think he should have picked them before he knew what the court decision was going to be. It would have been prudent to say, well, I'll select them depending on what the court decision is. I think Maguire compounded Southgate's problems by such an appalling performance when he got sent off at the game against Denmark. Straight away, that just raised more pressure back onto Southgate's decision making. And yeah, as Matthew was saying before, you know, the indiscipline of certain England players, and particularly me, Foden and Greenwood, I really struggled to even comprehend what was going through their minds with that incident in the Icelandic hotel. I think that's just suddenly created an impression of, compared to the man in 2018 who was oozing suave, calm, composed management of the England team altogether. You saw all those clips in the swimming pool where they're riding on unicorns and things like that, a very happy squad. That image is gone. It's coming across as a fragmented, disjointed squad. And I think because of that, questions are being asked about Southgate's leadership. Now, you know, from my perspective, I think the guy, based on his 2018 performance, deserves to be given some doubts, some credit here. I think he deserves to see the job through that he's been appointed to. But at the moment, he's in a difficult phase. And I think as well, previous manager, I've kind of found out to their cost that if there's a media favours who the press demand that you play, you don't play them, and then you get an uninspiring performance from the people chosen instead. You get criticised. And I'm thinking here of Jack Grealish, because Jack Grealish, quite impressed on his debut. There's a massive outcry for him to be included in the next game. He wasn't. It was a dire performance, and straight away he leaves himself open to criticism.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned earlier in that about the pressure brought on due to results. I mean, I guess largely what improved things around 2018, as you say, was how well they were doing. But I think adding to that, I mean, Southgate brought probably a more mature approach and better access and a bit more trust placed in players in the lead up to that tournament as well. So as much as the media were then riding the wave of good results and things were all much improved as a result of that, there was a bit of a change in attitude within the squad from Southgate, I think. But you know, Matthew, coming to you again, I guess this is apparent now that the results have dipped off, that the knives are out, as Paul's mentioned there. Will some of this pressure and scrutiny and, I guess, more fractious relationship ease off if England suddenly, I don't know, beat Belgium away in the next few weeks and make it to the Nations League semi-finals again, or do well in the Euros next summer? Will the relationship improve again simply as a result of that?
Probably, because the way that the media covers England is that it's like it's 100% or nothing. So, you know, we had a couple of bad international windows, and all of a sudden, like you say, the knives are out. The swing is huge. It's the pendulum swings so far. So yeah, if we, you know, we go to Belgium and stick five past them, all of a sudden we'll be Gareth Southgate the hero. I wanted to pick up on something that was said as well, because I think when you look at the sort of history of the way England is covered, the outlier, the weird one, is that 2018 World Cup, even more so than 1990. Because I found this really, really interesting article in Wired, of all places, you know, the media and tech magazine. They did a full spread, really in-depth analysis of what England did at the 2018 World Cup, where they embraced social media instead of being scared of it. They allowed the players to enjoy themselves publicly, giving them a lot more liberation when it comes to what they could say, what they could do with the days off. How they conducted themselves on social media. It was like a world away from being trapped in hotels for days on end, like in South Africa. There was trust, basically, trusting that these were adults that could behave like adults. And the public could see that we had this interesting bunch of characters with fun personalities and, you know, likable people. And it was all because they brought in a consultant, this woman called Sue Llewellyn. And she did that, her and Gareth Southgate and the FA team, they did a really concerted effort to change that public image to, you know, to change the way that the press view these people. I mean, I know there was, is it Jonathan Northcote, a journalist who wrote a book about the World Cup, and it's called Playing Darts with England Players or something like that. Everything was changing all because of that. You know, they made a really concerted effort to, you know, to change that perception. And it's something, it's a fascinating case study in, like, because it was wholly successful and lasted for, you know, changed the perception of the England team for years until apparently about 3 weeks ago. But I think it's just a really interesting point then how that World Cup is, you know, really different compared to all the others.
No, you're absolutely right there. It really was. I mean, it was noticeable even from TV snippets when they're doing the report from the England camp during the lead into games, of the ease the players were at in a sort of one-on-one situations with journalists, as you say, playing darts and various other things during their chats, weren't they?
They weren't scared of what the journalists would do to them. I mean, 3 weeks before is when the whole Daily Mail article came out about Raheem Sterling with the tattoo, the gun tattoo, which why it's of any concern to the Daily Mail that anybody what Raheem Sterling does with his body, I don't know. But it's like they said, there's like institutionalized racism against any black footballer, really. So, I totally agree. They weren't scared of journalists, basically.
When it comes, I think as well, going back to 2018, there's a real kind of sea change in the press attitude towards England as well, because when at the time, there's real focus on like Harry Kane, England captain, who was going out, was married to his childhood sweetheart. They'd been together for ages. There were no wags associated with 2018 particularly, whereas in previous World Cups, the focus had been more on the glamour side of the squad's partners who were on the trip with them. And I always remember when Wayne Rooney first broke through in 2002, the press were waiting outside the school gate to take pictures of Colleen coming out of the gates in their school uniform with a parka on. Not a very flashing photograph. But he was getting really criticised for, you know, the state of his girlfriend, this dowdy little schoolgirl, and being unfavourably compared to Jamie Redknapp, who was going out with Louise Nerding, and these other footballers who were going out with these wannabe warblers from the X Factor. And the whole, there'd been a real sea change in how England footballers were being perceived in 2018 compared to how they had been in the previous decade.
I think I think the point about this is a larger discussion about the newspapers that do this and who owns these newspapers and who are the people writing these articles. And I think it's sometimes easy to forget that football is a working class sport played by working class kids. And these are, you know, Wayne Rooney comes from quite a poor part of Liverpool, right? And, you know, he all of a sudden has all this money and there's this increased scrutiny on him. And you look at who are these people covering it, and it's sort of more middle-class journalists from London, from, you know, further down south who don't, I don't know. The coverage is different because of, you know, the background, and all of a sudden players will get criticised for spending this money that they've never had. So
That's a really good point, Matthew. Really good point.
Yeah, I think a lot of the coverage of England and a lot of coverage of footballers in Britain, like black footballers as well, comes from who's doing the coverage. And I think there's an element of classism and an element of class really involved in the way that it's all covered, but sort of talking out loud. But yeah, I think there is an element of class involved.
When you contrast 2006, as you mentioned there, the glamour approach of the wags and so on, and the partying in Baden-Baden, compare that with 2018, and it's worlds apart, isn't it? And I guess back then it was the final coattails of the laddish culture that had been in the 90s, I guess, and it was still the end of that, and with the so-called golden generation and all the wives and attention that came with it, pop star wives and models and so on, it kind of fed all of that, but it thoroughly distracted from the football, I think. Equally, in terms of the managers, I guess the hounding has changed. The treatment of Southgate is vastly different to, say, what Graham Taylor or Bobby Robson suffered, or even Ericsson not so long ago. Stephen, has that sort of matured in the press? We're talking about some of the other issues they are focusing on now. Has the particular hounding of the manager something that's matured or just lessened off over the years?
Yeah, it's just a product of its era, you know. So, you know, whatever Gareth Southgate's getting now is nowhere near the what was basically a vendetta almost. It was, you know, the personalized insults and so derogatory towards, you know, all going all the way back to Ron Greenwood in my era of watching football, to the point that, you know, people were, these managers were harangued on the doorsteps, and, you know, personal lies were dug at, and to see if there was some kind of scandal that could be used upon them. You know, I can remember that they would get cartoonists that would mock up images of managers in all sorts of degrading kind of like scenarios. You know, the infamous kind of like mocking of Taylor as a turnip from by an unmentionable media outlet. Stuff like that. I can remember some bizarre image of Bobby Robson, kind of like, attached to a block of concrete, but with a chain around his neck and naked. And you're thinking, who is even thinking these things up. And it was just an absolute, a vendetta almost, and you will get these horrendous back pages and it would rumble on for days. International breaks would come along and it would rumble on for days and weeks, and it would be held over until the next international break. And there was this image of the England manager as some kind of symbol of hatred almost, in it certainly in the tabloid media. It was absolutely ridiculous, some of the stuff that Greenwood, Robson, Taylor all went through. And yeah, some of them, had bad times as the England manager, made bad calls and led some poor football matches, but nothing that warranted the levels of invective, media coverage. It was absolutely shocking, a lot of it. And it kind of pivoted somewhat in probably Ericsson's reign. It changed somewhat, because so much about Ericsson was built around his private life and the coverage of Ericsson. And it was, Nancy DeLelio, wasn't it? And then various stories about, affairs that had happened and stuff like that. And it became a more of a kind of like a almost like carry on England manager. Because it seemed like they liked him personally, but they would bring these stories up about him. And, Glenn Hoddle was another one, wasn't it? And then everything around Eileen Drury and anything that could be used to mock him. And that's what it came down to. A lot of these characters were roundly mocked. And, in an era when they were, selling, trying to sell the back page headline, it was probably all the more. The less that newspapers have that level of importance, people, imbibe the news and sports news via so many different alternatives now. It doesn't have that same impact online, for instance. You don't have to have that sensationalism online. Not all online coverage is much more to do with the football, and it's the tactics and the players that have been selected. Even opinion pieces tend to be centred not on personal attacks on a manager, but more about the calls they're making in football matches and what's happening on the pitch. So I do think that move away from the omnipresence of the traditional newspaper, tabloid newspaper hack, having such a massive sway in public opinion has kind of gone. So, Southgate's got his hands cut out to keep the media on side, but it's completely different environment to what his predecessors had to go through.
And those hacks you're talking about, they all, of course, had the gall to claim that they were supportive of the team and wanted them to succeed, whereas pretty much everything they did suggested otherwise. I guess we'll see
So much of it was always mired in negativity. I'm not saying that they needed to be, overly positive, but it was just almost like it was a sport, this sport of negative reporting almost.
Well, I guess we'll see how the relationship, at least player-wise, may improve or deteriorate based on upcoming results. But from international to domestic matters now, and prior to a national lockdown being announced just this weekend, the FA had already decreed that next week's FA Cup first round games would all go ahead without any fans present. Obviously, Paul, when we first mooted this subject, we were all set for a discussion about these plans, not allowing fans at grounds which had already proved they could safely have fans in attendance in non-league football. But since then, obviously, matters have been taken out of the FA's hands somewhat. So that part of things might be a bit of a moot point now with regards to this first round of the Cup. But I guess the issue still remains about the loss of income to non-league teams in particular, but lower league teams as well, especially now that they may be a lengthy period without hosting fans, which they've become used to, at least in small numbers. I know from your experience at Marine that you know what that's like in terms of how it's being managed and so on. When talking about the FA Cup, obviously there's quite a number of lower teams in this first round hoping for a bumper payday that could see them through troubled times as it is right now. So it's a big issue for these clubs missing out on fans, not just in the FA Cup, but in their other games going forward now.
Yeah, it is. I think I mentioned last time I was on the show how impressed I've been with the arrangements at Marine. You know, in terms of you bought your ticket online, the hand sanitizer when you went to the ground. You're now given a place on the terrace where to stand as well. They've painted footprints in all the terraces, so you know you have to stand on the footprints during the game. So the whole arrangement has been very, very secure. And as far as I know, I've been to 7 home games this season, and not once has my NHS track and trace alert rung or contacted me. Then again, knowing how poorly that's performed, that might not be a surprise in the circumstances. But I think they've handled it really well. It's not just the going to the match bit. I mean, you know, Marine, like lots of non-league clubs, are focuses of their little community. You know, they do, you know, dementia sessions, they do walking football, they do community walks. So it's not just the football side, it's also the community side as well. I mean, going back to the first round of the FA Cup, well, one thing I didn't understand about it was, why on earth wasn't that regionalised? Well, what was the point of making clubs go up and down the country for a first round tie? I mean, what would have been the... Marina got to go down to Colchester. And, you know, all the clubs are going from the northeast to the southwest. To me, in the current national situation, that draw had to be regionalised. It's absolute madness that it wasn't. I know someone should have spoken to the FA beforehand and said, look, this draw has to be regionalised. In terms of the first rounds, I mean, Marina won the Red Button Games, has been chosen to be covered on the BBC. They're going to get 32,000 for that coverage. Now, the big debate now is whether non-elite clubs are going to be allowed to carry on in the FA Cup, because the government has said that elite sport can continue. And in my mind, elite sport takes you down to the National League North, National League South. But they haven't actually said whether teams below that level will be allowed to participate in the FA Cup. So that's going to be quite an interesting conversation to see what goes ahead there. And to me, it might not end out this way, but if it turns out that like some Marine, Skelmersdale and other lower teams cannot compete in the FA Cup because they are non-elite clubs, then to me, the FA Cup's gone. It's just lost its integrity. So there are some big decisions to be made there. I think the FA needs to argue a special case there that for the duration of the FA Cup, that non-elite clubs, for as long as they're still part of that competition, can compete their fixtures. And, I mean, for likes of Marine, to lose 32,000 if that game doesn't go ahead, that's a season's receipt. And, that you know, they cannot have... That's a life-changing sum for both that and Skelmersdale United, who are also being covered on the BBC as well. Those sums of money, non-league clubs cannot afford to lose.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of the interesting ties that are occurring this week, at least, should be, assuming they're allowed to go ahead. Skelmersdale United, they're in the Northwest Counties League, so they're the lowest ranked team remaining. Yeah. Their fans would be denied this chance to see their team in the first round, but they're not alone. There's FC United of Manchester, Tunbridge Angels, Maldon and Tiptree, to name but a few. I mean, it's a shame for all, but I guess most stark for Skelmersdale, given it's likely the biggest day in their club's history. I guess, Matthew, such occasions without fans for a club like them must be intensely frustrating.
Yeah, it really is, and it's crippling as well, because it's not just about the gate receipts, is it? It's everything. It's the like the pies that they sell, the beers that they'll sell, the food and drink, everything, all the businesses around the stadium, or the atmosphere during the game, you know, the opportunity to play against bigger teams, and not have the fans there, just kind of lose the magic a little bit. And it's really tragic. And I don't know what the solution is. If the government can't find a way to support it, I don't really know what the solution is, because it's one of those really difficult situations where we are living through a pandemic. So it's one of the ones like, how fully can you support taking the fans back, even in situations where, I don't know, it's like COVID secure. There's still always the element of doubt and whether fans will feel comfortable going back. I don't know, but it's down to like the government and the FA and the PFA and all, you know, the authorities to find out a way to get the money to make sure these clubs and these like pillars of communities don't go out of business. Because I mean, it's just tragic. It's the opposite of what we want to see.
On that theme, Bradford City fans groups have been collecting the money they would have been spending on their first round trip to Tunbridge Angels. To centre that non-league club, well, that's a heartwarming tale, of course, but that does lay bare the the problems for these non-league teams missing out on their biggest payday of the year. So that's a fan-led initiative, Stephen. But as Matthew's alluding to there, is there something else the FA should be looking at to try and address in these cases?
Yeah, there should be, if, you know, wherever possible. I mean, what those initiatives could possibly be is you know, impossible to say. Maybe some kind of maybe a pay per view type of thing, but a voluntary pay per view. You know, a positive pay per view type of aspect. You know, if there's a game like that, you know, pay what should be your fee on the turnstile. Knowing that it would go to the club would be, you know, a massive gesture. For instance, the Liverpool game against Burnley, I think it was, whatever the game was the other week when it was on pay-per-view, and there was a massive protest against it, and instead of paying the £15 pay-per-view fee to watch the game, Spirit of Shankly came up with the idea of contributing £5 to a fund to pay towards food banks, and with the idea that, oh, it'd be great if you could make £10,000, and in the end it swept over £100,000. You know, there is an appetite out there for community-based initiatives to help out. And I'm sure it could go across the breadth of football as well. If there was some kind of way to be able to contribute towards club, because we've seen it before in non-pandemic times. Accrington Stanley, for instance, were going through a huge amount of financial problems. They looked like they were going bust again at one point. And a campaign was brought forward to people, to of all supporters of many different clubs, to just tip up to a game, a home game, to put more money through the turnstiles. You know, football supporters, there are a lot of right-thinking, community-spirited football supporters out there that would happily contribute something in some manner, if it could be organised, to help a club out in such circumstances. You know, how that could be done, you know, I couldn't even begin to imagine, but, you know, I'd certainly happily contribute to a non-league club that is going to miss out on important funds.
Quite so. And I guess on this sort of generosity theme, Matthew, you want to have another word about Marcus Rashford and his latest campaigns and his progression towards sainthood, I think.
Marcus bloody Rashford, honestly. Exactly. Like, you say his name and leave it at, and everyone understands what you mean. Like, the work done over the past week and months is just beyond extraordinary. It's just like one young man's defiance against like an apparently uncaring government, and he's winning. He's lived through this. He's lived through the child poverty. He understood and remembers the difficulty, which I think a lot of us, even those of us from working class backgrounds, will like struggle to comprehend how scary a situation that is to be in, to not know where your next meal's coming from. And he's using this platform, his platform, to raise awareness of a problem that simply should not exist in a country as rich as Britain. And his movement as one of only 5 petitions ever to reach 1 million signatures. Over half term, he has inspired businesses already on their knees because of the pandemic to provide for hungry children when the government refused to. Over 700,000 children in Britain have had food to eat because of Rashford and because of those inspired by him. And the government tried to shrug him off, to thanks but no thanks, awarded him an MBE for his efforts, like clearly an effort to stop making them look bad. And this despite the hypocrisy of saying his efforts weren't necessary in the first place. And like, after his petition was rejected in Parliament, he spent the next 2 or 3 days retweeting local businesses that had promise to provide for children. His timeline was a place of such like warmth and generosity. I was just scrolling through like with tears in my eyes. It was just, it's just a nice, so nice. And even during this week, he had time to score a Champions League hat-trick against last season's semi-finalists. So honestly, I don't have the proper words to describe how incredible and lovely and moving a thing he's doing like at the minute. It is, yeah, there are no words. It's beyond extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, it's time to let the guests choose the topics rather than me. So with a chance to step up on the soapbox to tell us about any football theme of their choice, be it a rant or something to warm the heart with joy. Paul, how about you first?
Yeah, just while I go on to that, Aidan, can I just back up what Steve said there about the Spirits of Shankly movement, about, you know, they pay the pay-per-view fee to the food place. I thought that was a fabulous example of success. So no, all credit to, you know, to the Liverpool supporters who initiates that and went ahead with that. It deserves every praise. Okay, can I talk about St. Virgil?
You can.
Okay, right. As an Everton fan watching the derby, yeah, it was a clumsy challenge by Pickford. It was an awkward challenge. Yes, now, if he'd been sent off, I don't think any right-minded Everton fan would have objected to that decision. I think it wasn't his fault he wasn't sent off. That was down to the match officials. You know, if the red card had been awarded, I think there would have been no complaints. I think what's really kind of got on the skin of most Everton fans is the way the media just treated Pickford ever since that incident. I mean, football's a physical game. People get injured. You know, I think Van Dijk was in a challenge with Delafeu in February when the pool got beat at Watford, and Delafeu's season ended on the basis of that tackle, but somehow that's kind of been totally forgotten. After the game, the reaction from the likes of Graham Souness, of all people, you know, criticising the challenge. I mean, that's a bit rich, come on. You had Jamie Redknapp and then Danny Murphy. Oh, my God, who employs that guy? All coming in, all on their soapboxes about Pickford should be banned. No, it was awful. Pickford's a terrible man. He's the worst human being ever. How dare he tackle a Liverpool player? He should be banned for life. The reaction was just totally, totally over the top. You had the next referee, Keith Hackers, in the Daily Mirror saying that Liverpool should sue Pickford for the damage he's done to Virgil van Dijk, and had the cheek, the audacity, to compare Pickford's challenge, which was never intentional, compared to Roy Keane's premeditated assault on Alf Inge Haaland. I mean, words fail me. You had Mark Bosnich, who was not being part of the goalkeepers' union, by saying that Pickford should be banned for the length of time that Virgil van Dijk was out through injury. And then when Giorgio Wijnaldum said to the press, the players haven't slept since that incident. I mean, that was just really, that was just pushing it too far. I mean, come on, is the guy serious? And then he complained, Everton players are always like this in these sorts of games. So what do you want us to do, George? You just lay down and admire your skills as you beat us 5-0 again with the team of under 18s. Sorry, that is never, ever going to happen. So even the Times, Henry Winter jumped in on criticising Pickford, making him out to be, you know, one of the most vicious human beings on the planet. So the reaction has just been totally, totally over the top. And I mean, it was an unfortunate injury, but to say that Pickford meant to do that deliberately, it's not true. It was a clumsy challenge. And the fact now that Pickford has to have an armed guard, the fact he's had death threats from people, is just absolutely outrageous. I mean, part of the reason why Ancelotti didn't play him today was because he was really concerned about his mental health. The lack of support from the PFA to try and come and back Pickford up a little bit and offer a bit of support. So it's a physical game. People get hurt. It's just been totally non-existent. So I found that incredibly frustrating as well. And then my mind can't help going back to this time last year when Son committed the challenge on Gomez, which led to a fracture in his ankle. And you could see the agony Gomez was on the pitch. Yeah, all the media could do was concentrate on Son's tears, and Son was really upset, and Son was crying at the end of the game. There wasn't even a moment's thought to what had been done to Gomez. And Gomez has not been the same player since that injury, but that's kind of carefully been forgotten about as well. I mean, I wish Virgil van Dijk all the best. He's a brilliant defender. He's a great footballer. I don't wish injuries on any other opposition player. But the way Pickford has been vilified by in the media, in the press, in the TV studios, it's been appalling. Quite frankly, being you in AA, I mean, you know the way that, as Newcastle fan, you know the way that, like, Paul Gascoigne kind of just couldn't cope with that type of media scrutiny. Now, I see parallels between Pickford and Paul Gascoigne in terms they are both sort of a bit on the edge the way they play their games. And you know, the constant hostility that Pickford has been subjected to on a 24-hour-a-day basis since the derby match, to me, it's just not right. It doesn't sit right with me. It was a clumsy challenge. It wasn't intentional. He didn't mean to hurt him. It was just an unfortunate consequence that Van Dijk got injured. But the way he's been treated ever since then, to me, it's just not right.
No, I agree. It, it does seem to have gone on too much. And I think in Pickford's case, it's adding to the attention he's already under for various poor decisions on the field and, you know, goalkeeping related issues that he seems to be under high scrutiny, probably because he's the England goalie, at least has been. Maybe that'll change now he's been dropped at Everton. I don't know. But I think
he's playing next game, Aidan.
Right. Okay.
He's only dropped for today's game.
Okay. Well, good luck. Good. That was good for Newcastle anyway then. But I think this is just adding on top, piling on top of the extra scrutiny he seems to be under for every goalkeeping mistake he makes, whether he's letting things in, making poor decisions that other people would claim other goalies or a goalie who should be of international class wouldn't do, and comparing him with obviously other England contenders. To add this on top of that is quite a lot to bear for someone who does seem slightly fragile of temperament, as you mentioned there. I mean, we've got the other half of Merseyside on here too, and Stephen, before opening up your soapbox moment, do you want to come back on Paul's point?
I'd tell you what Pickford's problem there is, that it's the way that football clubs have been made to kind of cocoon themselves, and they overprotect their players somewhat. So, you know, for Pickford's instance, this has gone against him in the last fortnight or so. You know, if there was a more open aspect where he could just come out and say, look, that was a reckless challenge, and, you know, I didn't do it on purpose. No, I don't think anyone on the Liverpool side, a proper Liverpool side, really thinks he did that on purpose. It was a reckless challenge that he would have regretted immediately, and I'm positive of that. But if he was allowed to just come out and to the press and say, you know, in the immediacy of it, and said, you know, that was, you know, I shouldn't have done that. You know, it happened. I wish I could take it back. You know, I wish him all the best. You know, that would have done. You know, but in today's football climate, players aren't allowed to do that type of thing. That would have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, a player causes an injury with a challenge they shouldn't have made. They'd come out and they'd put their hands up and say, yeah, I stepped over the mark there. You know, I will endeavour not to do that type of thing ever again. Wish him all the best, you know, and then everything moves on. Football happens, you know, injuries happen. But I think that loss of honesty, I think that loss of freedom for players to be able to say something like that, you know, that would diffuse such a massive amount of a situation like this.
Okay, how about your chosen topic then, Stephen?
My chosen topic, I'd probably just go back and repeat the pay-per-view initiative. I think that was a brilliant thing, and I would love to see every single prospective pay-per-view game be dealt with in exactly the same manner. You know, don't pay the £15 to watch that match. You know, give it to a good cause. You know, whether that's dinners for school children, food banks, anything whatsoever. You know, presents for kids for Christmas. You know, don't pay £15 for your pay-per-view. You know, put £5 in some kind of, you know, worthy community charity box of some description. You know, I'd love, you know, supporters to be organised enough to be able to do that for every single one of these games that's that trips across the fixture list. And and then I'll also echo what Matthew said about Marcus Rashford, who is just a tremendous individual. And it's great to see, this is the positive side of football and professional footballers. And this is great to see that there is no perceived handbrake being put on Marcus Rashford by the club that he plays for either, which is brilliant to see. You know, he seems to have that freedom that I've just spoke of with regards to Jordan Pickford's situation. You know, no one seems to be stopping Rashford doing what he's doing, and more power to the man.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of the pay-per-view thing you're talking about just before there, Stephen, Newcastle against Manchester United the previous weekend was one of the the first day's tranche of PPV games that came on, and there were huge campaigns in the lead up to that in this area to do exactly Absolutely. What you're saying there as well about it was the whole 1495 people were encouraged to give to a food bank that's actually bears the name NUFC. I don't know whether it's actually run by the club or done in conjunction with them or what, but they raised tens of thousands, as you'd imagine, from that campaign, and not very many people watched the game, I don't believe. So not there was Good. Anything for us to actually view in that game, but in terms of the the charity and so on, that was hugely symbolic and really a really worthy cause, absolutely. Matthew, then, how about you?
I had prepared Marcus Rashford as my soapbox moment, but I will echo I will echo what people have said though about the PPV and the worthy causes that have been across the country. And to add on to that it was just in the first place absolutely disgusting that the Premier League charged £15 in the middle of a pandemic when hundreds and thousands of people across the country are being laid off from work and don't know where the next paycheck is coming from, for them to charge £15 on top of however much it is a month, you have to pay like hundreds of pounds a month to watch all the football if you want to see it. Just beyond the joke, it's yeah, unfathomably dumb and kind of evil.
Yes, indeed. And the whole nature of finance in football is something we're going to get into on next month's episode of this pod. So pay-per-view. Yeah, I know, exactly. Pay-per-view is going to come into that quite considerably, I'm quite sure. If I may be permitted a quick one too, a certain Diego Maradona turned 60 last week, so it's a good opportunity to view the great Maradona movie, if anyone hasn't seen that yet, or for anyone wanting something a little different, I can highly recommend the Netflix documentary series Maradona in Mexico, about his time coaching Dorados de Sinaloa in the Mexican League. It's a really interesting series, so well worth a look and a timely thing to watch when the great man turns 60. Anyway, there's plenty of other stuff going on at these football times as usual. Our latest magazine on River Plate has landed in people's homes this week. And keep a lookout for our next one, which will be launched for pre-order a week or so after this pod comes out. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. Lots more on the podcast front as well, with more Centre Circle episodes discussing some recent books by some of our very own TFT crew. There's one on Stephen's book on the chic years of the UEFA Cup, and another looking at Stuart Horsfield's book on Brazil's 1982 team and their glorious failure in something of an ode to the wonders of that side, which captivated a young Stuart so vividly. And as always, there's plenty of great online writing too. So to round things off as usual, I'll get each guest to flag up a recent article from the website that they particularly liked. For mine, I've gone for a piece by Rahul Warrior on Victor Maslov, which is shining a light on a great innovator and revolutionary of the game, who's a little bit overlooked. He was a pioneer of what became a fairly familiar 4-4-2, but at the time, that was adapting a Brazilian 4-2-4 system and then developing a means of gaining midfield dominance and attacking fullbacks as well, and a strong collective ethos. So he was a huge influence on the pioneering days and influenced the great Lobanovsky too, as this article does a great job of showing how deep this influence ran across the game. So that's a particular one that struck my fancy recently. And Paul, have you picked anything out for us?
Yeah, I picked out the article by Jim Hart. Now, I know Jim sadly died 2 years ago, and I think Stephen knows him far better than what I do, because I think I'd only been with these football times about 9 months or so when he sadly dies. And I was always anxious to read one of his articles, so I was delighted when his article about Gianna Brera came up on the site a few days ago. And it's a fascinating article about Italian journalist Gianna Brera, who kind of invented the language that's used in Italy to describe so much of their football at the moment. So he came up with the words of central campista for the midfielder. He came up with the word libero for a sweeper. But he was also fascinated by the tactics of football. He was the first kind of journalist, mainstream journalist in Italy, who devoted his writing on the tactics that teams were using, the formations that teams were using, rather than just turning out your standard match reports. And he was so fascinated by tactics that was always said about him that for him, his perfect afternoon watching football would be a 0-0 draw where both sides' tactics cancelled each other out. That for him would have been heaven. So he sounded like a really unique guy. It was a really fascinating article. I enjoyed reading it. And, it just shows what a quality, high-quality writer Jim was.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And Who to next? Matthew, how about you?
Yeah, I chose the article by Dan Billingham about, and I'm going to get this wrong, but Toguchi Munchen, a club in Munich who have recently made it into the third division of German football for the first time in their history. It's a really fascinating story about the first club founded by migrants to reach the professional leagues in Germany. So it's Turkish migrants. And it's interesting that they're very much a community club who have received a lot of praise for their integration work, but they also don't want to be defined by their identity, even though they take a lot of pride in it. It's a really interesting read about Turkish migrants in Germany and how the people who own the club find it amusing when they get called the Turks, even though there are so many other players playing in the opposition teams with Turkish players and Turkish names. And it's, yeah, really nicely written. It's an interesting story, which I'd recommend.
Fantastic. And Stephen, I know you came to us late, but have you managed to pick something out for us?
I have indeed, and it was one written by our host on the South American World Cup qualifiers. I absolutely love that article very, very much indeed. I love an article that it takes from history, but it also adds a personalised touch to it, as well. It's not an easy set of streams to cross, going all a bit Ghostbusters there. But it was brilliant. I absolutely loved reading that one because it ticks every box for me there, and I too love the South American World Cup qualifiers and fear the worst for the future in the expanded World Cup and how it will alter and lose its meaning somewhat. But having just taken part in the South America finals. Online series, the YouTube series that's going to be coming out soon. It absolutely ticked every box for me, that one.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much. And you're right, they certainly will just do their best to destroy that when it comes to the next World Cup. And this would be the last chance for it to be remotely at this level of competitiveness, I think.
Exactly. So it's enjoy it while it lasts before they change it again.
Well, plenty more where all those came from, of course, so do check out our whole back catalogue online. But we'll wrap up there for today. All that remains is to thank my guests for making it such a good discussion as always. Paul, thanks very much. Glad you're still talking to me after the Newcastle-Everton result today.
I'm still thinking about that one, Aidan.
Good stuff. And Matthew, thanks again, and thanks for keeping highlighting Rashford's efforts with us.
Always. If you want me to come on and talk about Rashford, I'm happy.
Good stuff. And Stephen, thanks to you too for stepping in so expertly at the last minute. A veritable David Fairclough against St Etienne performance from you.
It was a joy as always. And always happy to jump in at the last second if needs be. Brilliant stuff.
Cheers then. And thanks to all our listeners, of course. We'll hope to catch you again next time. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.